This is Donnie Rove, and you are tuned into Word Life, where we unpack the intersections of literary art, music, politics, and revolution. Art imitates life. Life is often a series of rebellions. Let's dive into the messages inspired by the movements. I became involved in the game of slam poetry at the top of the 21st century after a couple of years of performing poems at open mics in my hometown of Baton Rouge. I intentionally used the word game instead of genre when referring to slam poetry because that is what it is, a literary game. Since 1986, poets of varying backgrounds, identities, and walks of life have competed in this performance sport in every setting imaginable. From bars to coffee houses to galleries to university student centers to wherever, an audience would come willing to gather and hear wordsmiths spill their soul and have their art be judged by everyday folks. In the nearly four decades since the inception of this game, the persistent motto has always been that the points are not the point, the poetry is the point. And in no place has that idea rang more true than at national and regional slam tournaments. Attending, and especially competing in a national or regional poetry slam tournament, is like stepping into a countercultural society. For anywhere from 3 days to a full week, depending on the tournament, poets of every ethnicity, gender, orientation, and socioeconomic background imaginable have the opportunity to have their voices centered among their peers and poetry enthusiasts. It is almost as if all of the silencing and marginalizing that many of its participants receive in the outside world is temporarily suspended, and the voices of the disenfranchised are the most valuable ones in existence. This is not to suggest that the world of poetry slam is completely void of societal ills that are common to everyday life. A large part of the culture is the idea that it considers itself to be a truly democratic space, and that does not always allow for its participants to be vetted along the lines of morality. Slam, as an open platform, has been both a lighthouse for its participants to express themselves in a world that has often attempted to mute their cries, as well as an unfortunate hiding place for souls that were as tortured as they were talented. Over the past few decades, some of this generation's most prolific writers have emerged from the world of poetry slam. Some of the country's best-selling authors, revered essayists, dynamic musicians, and decorated educators were at one time or another strategizing in the back of a slam venue at a tournament, hoping to put poems on a stage that would gain the respect of their peers and allow them the opportunity to hoist up a trophy. At its essence, slam gives its participants real-time responses to their work from randomly selected judges that score pieces based on the merit of the writing and performance. But beyond the judges and the points and the strategizing is a community that is formed between members of marginalized populations who find camaraderie in the art of sharing and listening. I competed in poetry slams at the national level for over a decade and met some of the most interesting personalities I'd ever known. And that's an understatement. What I mean is, I've met poets who became extended family. Poets who have shared positive affirmations with me, said prayers on my behalf, cheered on my accomplishments outside of dimly lit performance spaces, and stood heel to heel with me in fighting for justice in the real world when there was no applause to be gained. One such poet is my guest on this episode of Word Life, a veteran by the name of Emoja Moman Sumler, whose radical leftist poetry and activism has been a staple in slam circles for over two decades. Emoja Sumler is a poet, essayist, chef, podcast host, and author of the poetry collection Fables, Foibles, and Other American Sins, which is described as a gothic noir that gives readers an unflinching look at a world of white menace. Moman is a legend in the Southern poetry community and someone who absolutely abides by the politics he writes about in his work. We talk about a piece from Fables, Foibles, and Other American Sins titled The Key to Hitting, which speaks about the symbolism of Thomas Jefferson's abuse of those he enslaved as a metaphor for abuse Black Americans endure at the hands of the system, the abuse we extol on each other, and the lineage of violence in the South that haunts Black life to this very day.
The key to hitting for Crit. Jefferson's key to productivity, hitting. Backs of Black Virginia the tobacco needs a hard, dark clay tilled with potash and long summer sun like you couldn't even believe. The enslaved are a pricey investment and often disrespectful breed. One must oversee like a proper stepdad. Mama Hemming said, never call him stepdad or stare directly in his eyes, spare a hitting. He look at Ma so lecherous, disrespectful. I try to pick leaves, but forgetting is hard. She ain't as young as she once was, but he's still an old ass man who be touching her in ways I don't like. Ma say, my hair needs a cutting, starting to look like Master's texture under his wig, skip a step. Dad's bloody back is etched in whip patterns that paint a pathway back to another land, a home. Hitting is our only hope. Dear God, hoping hurts this hard. And I think you not helping is disrespectful. He hit me again. Say I speak disrespectful. He crossed. Guess he see the Jesus Christ in me like this burnt copper and kink shorn body, blistered hard, exists only for the pleasure of my stepdad. Ma saw him and cried out. Now she's older hitting. Moon's arising, leading yoked oxen, tilling a patch of earth. Hoeing is laborious work. A lot of things go wrong. Stony soil's disrespectful. Black cast iron goes dull until a sharp hitting. Feel hands seize moment, casting collars, running like bucks, running like men for office, just like stepdad, running like oxen, running from whip, running hard. Ran like rivers, hiding their scent, making it hard for the hounds to do their work. Noses sniffing a snack for the nooses on the gallows for stepdad. Jeffersonian kindness, disrespectful. People say your eyes pop, neck snaps, tongue bulges like a gorged cock, drunk with the assumption, hitting hard. Hitting Ma, disrespectful. Him hitting Dad, hit me in the feels. It feels a lot like stepdad hits because he hates not hitting.
So talk to me, if you will, about the premise of this piece. What, I guess for lack of a better word, what was the inspiration? What was the... What's the thought pattern in which you were trying to get across, both from a stylistic standpoint and a messaging standpoint?
Yeah, man, I was listening to Crit, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, most people know I lived in three Southern states. My art is intrinsically tied to Black life down South, you know what I'm saying? I remember I was listening to a track in Manny Fresh, opened up the track by saying this track is hitting hard like a disrespectful stepdad. So like I wanted to do kind of like a reverse golden shovel, you know what I'm saying? So I use those as the lines to kind of be my inspiration. I'm like, what would a disrespectful stepdad look like? You know what I'm saying? And then like wanting to keep it grounded in the metaphor of the South, I was just thinking about the whole relationship, you know what I'm saying, between Sally Hemings and Jefferson. It's just fabulous to me. It's fantastic to me. In the American imagination, we can still look at somebody like Thomas Jefferson like some kind of moral figure. You know what I'm saying? And it is a man who was in his late 40s, you know, having relations. I'm trying to be as kind as possible with a 14-year-old person that he also put on his tax records as property. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I mean, already it gives you all kinds of implications as far as consent go. You know what I'm saying? How can a person you own say no? You know, that's one of the number one things I hear is, oh, him and Sally Hemings were in love. Like, we don't have knowledge of things like, Stockholm syndrome, you know, where, like, you know, you don't grow to have affection for your captor sometimes, especially when the consequences of saying no are so much, you know. And all of them kids that came from that union, you know, none of them could ever go to their dad, who is the president of the United States at one point in their life. You know what I'm saying? So they always have to think about him as stepdad. I mean, it's just, to me, the implications of that were just astounding, and they were falling in on me. And so I wanted to do something that was a real elegant kind of look at that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think the sestina is a really challenging form, really difficult to come up with something that has a good resonance because the words have to be repeated. And I wanted the poem to be a soft trigger because this is what enslavement is. When we talk about what triggering language is, when you talk about the concept of chattel slavery, I mean, it's so horrific. This is literally why we have these legislators now like, nah, we can't even talk about this in schools. You know, we can't do it. Okay. And so it's got to be in the art where we tell these stories. It's really one of the only places that's left for us. Understanding that art comes from the same word as artifice, you know, where we recreate these scenarios that happen and we tell these essentially beautiful lies. You know, does this poem happen exactly the way it did in history? Not at all. But it's a reenactment of something that I feel like especially every Black Southerner feels when we think about these people that are called founding fathers.
Mm-hmm. So this poem is a part of your collection, Fables, Foibles, and Other American Sins. I want to ask you, where does it fit within the grander collection of work? So what purpose is the hitting poem serving within the collection?
Right. So it talks about the other American sins. You know what I'm saying? It's like, we have to look at all of the things that made this country, to really have an appreciation for this country. If we're talking about something in the form of beauty without addressing the things that are ugly or imperfect about it, we do a disservice. We're painting it in a way that doesn't truly exist. We're using light with no shadows. You know what I'm saying? But it's the shadows that add depth and fullness to any image that we can create. You know, what happened to the Black American is the shadow on America that can never be dimmed. It can never be. The only thing that we could possibly compare to our experience would be the indigenous experience. You know what I'm saying? And so, like, I don't care that it's not something that people want to talk about anymore. I don't care that it's something that people feel like we should get over, because we're talking about something that happened less than four generations ago for a lot of people, you know, six generations at the most. There are still families that are rich from the money they made in enslavement. So we can't be over it. So long as wealth can inherit, which is the inherent capitalist thing, right? It's a game of collect everything. But we were something that was collected. Not only could we not collect, we were collected. You know what I'm saying? Without understanding that, you can't understand America. So, like, for me, it's impossible. You know, one of the leitmotifs of this book is this concept called the Gothic Noir, which is, you know, the Gothic is all about something that's beautiful, but a little bit past its prime, right? And now apply that to the lens of Blackness, because what is the most beautiful thing in this world as told by American exceptionalism? America. And America is beautiful, but we get to live in the shadows. We get to see the places where the skyscraper got cracks. You know what I'm saying? So, like, it's beautiful, but it's a castle. You know, we can see the decay, and people don't want to talk about the decay. I think the Black experience, the Black art experience, we have to talk about the decay. You know, Empress has no clothes. You know, it's that kind of scenario. Somebody got to speak truth to power, you know.
So that kind of leads me to my next question, which is a twofold question. What do you feel is the responsibility of the Black poet? But then more specifically, what do you feel is your responsibility as a Black poet?
I feel like my responsibility is to tell my truth as I understand it. You know what I'm saying? Without necessarily shading it for the gaze that goes beyond my de facto demographic experience. I'm not here to make the past more palatable. I'm not here to make my art more palatable. Look, man, I'm a Black dude that grew up in the hood. Most of the homies I came up with are dead or in jail. Some for life. You know what I'm saying? Like, this has been my American experience. I've lived in 3 different cities that were the murder capital of the world at one time or another. You know what I'm saying? These are the things that formed my consciousness. These are the realities I saw. You know, I think about this all the time. You know, the South was dueling culture. I mean, before the Wild West even, you know what I'm saying? I mean, take 6 steps and turn. This is the culture where we come from. So when we're trying to understand why the South is such an inherently violent place and why that violence is almost always personal, you know, which is very different from other parts of the country. You know, violence is mostly indifferent in New York. That dude don't know you. He just wanted your wallet. You know, when violence happens down South, it's often personal. You know the person. You understand how y'all got here. You know what I'm saying? That's the world that shaped me. That's what I have to write about. They say write about what you know. This is what I know. You know what I'm saying? And, for me, it's impossible. It's impossible to write this in a way where it is shaded in anything other than what it is. I don't try to make it better or worse than it is. I just try to tell it as I saw it. So for me, I feel like my obligation is to talk about the reality of a once young Black man still in his prime, as it related to what I came from. You know, my America is not everybody's America. My America is not unique. You know my America very well as a Southern Black man from Baton Rouge. You know, same rules apply. You know, I was just thinking about Dolph getting popped. You know, Memphis 2 hours away from Little Rock, where I lived for a very long time. You know, I thought about his hip hop beat for a long time. And I was just telling my homie, Amin Drew Law, great poet, down South, you know, it's very dangerous to have rivals in your city. Like, you could do that Biggie Pac stuff where he in L.A. and, you know, you in New York and y'all making records and making money. You know, I was thinking about, like, down South, bro, rivalries in the city, man, somebody gonna die, bro. That's Southern violence. You know, we know each other and you have insulted my honor. Honor culture is a huge part of where we come from, you know. And I just wanted to show that, what honor looks like from our perspective, you know, ways that we have been dishonored. But ways that we carry dignity still throughout this experience.
I want to lean a little bit into this idea of Southern violence and the tie-in to this poem in particular, the hitting poem, because what it really does for me is unpack this idea of abuse, the abuse of Jefferson as an enslaver onto, you know, his quote-unquote mistress, right? But actually someone he was sexually assaulting, right?
And the children that come from. And we're still being kind.
Right. And the trajectory of abuse, right? So if I look at this poem, which again, you know, the repetition of hitting and this idea of abuse, what do you say, or what would you say about how the trajectory and the lifespan of abuse to Black bodies have just kind of continued to play out in Southern culture? You know what I mean? And at what point did that abuse, not at what point, like, what do you see the parallels between the abuse of a Thomas Jefferson and the abuse of the way cats in the hood abuse each other by way of gun violence? Like, is there parallels? Do we see the historical trajectory, you know what I mean, play out a particular way between what you're talking about with Thomas Jefferson and how Southern Black folks, particularly Southern Black men, engage with each other violently in present times?
Absolutely, right? So, of course, as I said earlier, honor culture is a huge part of what it is like coming up down South, you know what I'm saying? Because especially when you come from the hood, without being a respected person, it becomes much easier to be victimized, you know, by the hood or by systems in general. But what I'm really interested in talking about is like the connections of that violence as that poem goes to the continued systems of violence as they relate down south. For example, what we're talking about is work conditions, right? Of course, there's the underlying theme of this is probably your son. And you still whip him just like you whip everybody else. But really, we have servants being whipped by a master class. You know, I think about the whole Amazon thing as it played out last year, you know, where they're threatening people with being fired if they vote for a union that would have allowed them to have collective bargaining rights, right? Where you're looking at their stories of people that are wearing diapers on Amazon floors because they don't even have enough time to go to the bathroom, right? That is violence. That is just as much violence as two people that fight each other after school, two people that brandish pistols. That is still holding someone's life over their hands. The South has never had unions specifically because it was seen that predominantly the workforce was Black. And they did not want Black people having that collective ability to engage with repercussions against their employer, which has always been the ownership class. That to me is a direct parallel between Jefferson back when the violence could be individualized. This person owns you. Now this corporate entity owns you. And it is violence. They may not have to whip you, but they threaten your life. If I say I will fire you for doing this thing that you have the constitutional obligation and freedom to do, you are threatening my life. Because if I'm two paychecks away from being homeless, as most Americans are, you are threatening me with homelessness, possibly my family, all of these things, simply because I want to get together with my fellow worker and determine that you pay me a fair wage. You know, if you're telling me I'm gonna be homeless, that's hitting me. It's hitting me financially. It's hitting me spiritually. You know what I'm saying? It's damaging me in all of these ways. Of course, yeah, the homies get together and sometimes they brandish them things. Sometimes they do those things, but that's still individualized violence, which will always pale in the face of systemic systems. And so for me, the poem is a more direct connection to the ways that we're still implementing violence against workers who do not meet our expectations.
Structural violence. Cool. So the last thing I want to ask you about is really general. If you were to identify Umoja, Moman, Sumler's artistic statement, what statement do you believe or do you intend for your art to make? Like, so let's just say, you know, hypothetically, is you have transitioned to the afterlife or whatever, and someone is trying to describe to people what did you do as a poet, as an essayist, as a creative? What's the artistic statement? Like, what's the intention of your art?
Right. So for me, I want to be a hyper-realistic mirror, right? Something that just reflects the state of the environment that has formed me and many like me. You know what I'm saying? I think about Nikki Giovanni's Nikki Rosa poem, where she talks about how like people never understand what it is to be poor. They never understand what it is to be like, you know what I'm saying? Financially disadvantaged. You know what I'm saying? Because people think that you're not having a good time. I've been in so many dangerous positions where like literally just the life that I live could have cost me my life. You know what I'm saying? But I'm having a great time to the ability that I can. And I'm going to show that in my art. You know, just like Nikki Rosa, like it's the best of the times is the worst of the times, you know, to crib homie. You know what I'm saying? Like, even in spite of all of the violence that we have to endure daily, you know, they talk about 50 microaggressions a day, right? But I understand there's no way that they're truly, truly compensating for the amount of violence that Black people go through. You know, I'm a man with locks. I can't tell you how many times somebody I don't know with a significantly lighter complexion just comes up and touches my hair. Like it's my hair, you know, it's a part of my body. That's violent. You know what I'm saying? The ability to reach out and touch someone whenever you want to. Like, even in spite of all of that, you know, I have a poem about that in there, you know, about and that is a homage to Amiri Baraka, you know, and just the experience of what it is to be a Black Southerner, a Black male Southerner, you know, going through that. I want to paint this world, not prettier or uglier than it is, but I do want to paint it accurately and from a vantage point that we hardly ever see. So truth from the hood, man. You know, hood art is good art. It doesn't make it lesser, you know. It doesn't make it a art with a lowercase a. You know, not all of us come from upper middle class Black families. Some of us came from other parts of America and we have stories to tell, you know, and it's real art. You know, it's not like something else, like, oh, well, that art too.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Word Life. Be sure to check us out next Thursday for another episode and be sure to leave us a gold star review. Until then, peace, creativity, and revolution.